Diverse Times. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting in Syria. Islamic State fighters launched counterattacks that have reportedly pushed Russian-backed government forces out of Raqqa province and tried to break the grip of U.S.-backed Syrian rebels on the outskirts of the IS-held town Manbij. Regional analyst Stephen Zunis says it underscores the Islamic State's continued potency despite recent setbacks.
Very few guerrilla groups and virtually no terrorist groups have been able to mount this kind of conventional counterattack. So this is indeed a reminder that we're not dealing with an ordinary terrorist group here.
Meanwhile, the UN said Monday it was able to deliver food and medical aid to besieged Syrians near Damascus. In Washington, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says he plans to meet department employees who co-signed a so-called dissent cable on U.S.-Syria policy. Kerry called it well-written and good. White House spokesman Josh Earnest was asked if President Obama shared that view.
The president does believe that having a procedure in place for State Department employees to make their dissenting views known is valuable. But I think we've been just as clear about the president's policy in Syria, how it has not led yet to the results that we would like to see in Syria, but it has prevented a repetition of mistakes that previous administrations have made.
The 51 mostly mid-level State Department diplomats called for targeted airstrikes against the Syrian regime as a means of exerting pressure on it to pursue a political settlement. The Democratic Republic of Congo declared a yellow fever epidemic in three provinces, including the capital, Kinshasa. After confirming nearly 70 cases, five people have died, more than 1,000 suspected cases of yellow fever. This is VOA News. The United States has criticized Bahrain for stripping the country's leading Shia cleric of his nationality. That sparked street protests and new concerns over sectarian tension. The country's news agency accused Sheikh Issa Qassem of playing a role in creating an extremist sectarian atmosphere, abusing his position and serving foreign interests, a possible reference to Iran. U.S. spokesman John Kirby expressed alarm at the government's action.
We are unaware of any credible evidence to support this action, and that assessment is further supported by the fact that he did not appear to even have the opportunity to challenge the charges against him before the decision was made. So we're going to be following this, obviously, very closely.
The island nation off the Arabian Peninsula has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising by a majority Shia demanding greater rights in the Sunni-led monarchy. An Iraqi commander said U.S.-backed government forces are battling Islamic State fighters in the western districts of Fallujah. Lieutenant General Abdul Wahab al-Saidi said the offensive, which entered its fifth week Monday, has been slowed by IS snipers, suicide attacks, and mortars. IS militants are still said to be in control of the northern Golan neighborhood. President Obama, speaking Monday in Washington, announced creation of a Los Angeles-based manufacturing hub called Smart Manufacturing. It's receiving $70 million in funding to develop technologies to reduce waste, save energy, and streamline the manufacturing process. Mr. Obama also promoted the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement, currently before Congress for an up or down vote.
When we've gotten it done, the Trans-Pacific Partnership will do even more to lower the costs of exporting, eliminating taxes and custom duties, and raising intellectual property standards that protect data and ideas and jobs.
He addressed a group of some 2,400 investors attending the Select USA Summit and considering doing business in the U.S. A British man is being held without bail in Las Vegas, Nevada, accused of trying to take a policeman's gun and shooting Republican Party presumptive presidential candidate Donald Trump during a recent rally. A judge determined that Michael Stephen Sanford is a potential danger to the community and a flight risk. He is to remain in custody until another court date, July 5th. Tunisia extended a state of emergency in the North African country for another month. It's been in place since November following a series of terrorist attacks, including a suicide bombing that killed 12 members of the Presidential Guard, claimed by Islamic State. The investigation into the murder of three young civil rights activists, which became known internationally as the Mississippi Burning Case, was officially closed Monday for lack of further prosecution. The fate of two white men and one black man in June 1964, who took part in the so-called Freedom Summer voting registration project, was said to be a key event leading to the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria devalues its currency amid a looming recession.
It allows for the pain to come off quicker and for recovery to come through sooner.
That's economist Yvonne Mango of Renaissance Capital Sub-Saharan Africa. Zimbabwe's shift to the South African rand and Chinese yuan is being hampered by the shortages of these currencies. South Sudan's judges' strike spreads to other parts of the country, and 2015 was the deadliest for environmental activists.
We documented 185 killings across 16 countries. That's almost a 6% increase from the previous year. On average, more than 3 people were killed every week in 2015.
That's Bill Kite of Global Witness. A Niger town is abandoned after Boko Haram attack. And why is the English language becoming a very popular subject of study in schools and universities across Senegal? Those stories plus Marco Uman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria floated its currency on Monday after holding the value of the naira steady for months despite slowing economic growth and shrinking production of its main export, oil. The move is expected to help Africa's largest economy as it moves into a recession. Chris Stein reports from Lagos.
For months, Nigeria has been holding the value of its currency at about 200 naira to the dollar, despite calls by some economists and foreign investors to let the currency lose value. President Muhammadu Buhari resisted, saying a devalued currency would hurt local industries. Buhari changed course last week. The central bank made the surprise announcement that the currency would not simply be devalued, but would be allowed to freely trade against other currencies like the dollar and euro. Renaissance Capital Sub-Saharan Africa economist Yvonne Mashongo said Nigeria had little choice but to let its currency fall.
They're running out of the firepower, which is the reserves. And secondly, something that I think they didn't anticipate, or no one did, was how much oil production would fall.
A series of militant attacks on pipelines and infrastructure on the oil-producing Niger Delta region has cut Nigeria's oil production in half. Oil is Nigeria's top export. The drop in production, along with the global slump in the price of oil to around $50 per barrel from about $100 two years ago, is one reason why Nigeria is expected to soon enter a recession. The recession is inevitable, Mashongo says, and will probably last at least 12 months. But the devaluation will help Nigeria get back on track.
It allows for the pain to come off quicker and for recovery to come through sooner.
Buhari is a recent believer in devaluing the currency. For months, he argued that a devalued naira would hurt the poor. Nigeria is dependent on imports for much of its consumer goods. Allowing the value of the currency to fall would drive up prices, he said. Foreign currency to pay for imports, however, has grown scarce in Nigeria, and importers were for months forced to buy dollars at high black market prices to pay their bills. That means inflation has already spiked, reaching 15.6% in May. While Mashongo expects inflation to increase, Nigeria can take steps to cushion the pain to consumers.
What I'd anticipate is, or expect is bold rate hikes, which is typically what happens when a currency devalues by such a substantial amount.
The naira had weakened to 259 to the dollar by late Monday. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
The South African rand and Chinese yuan are becoming scarce in Zimbabwe as the country attempts to shift to these currencies to address the current cash shortages, especially the United States dollar. Bank lines are now the order of the day in a nation with a fast declining economy brought on by subdued industrial production, low exports, lack of foreign direct investment, and other issues. Thomas Chiripasi of VOA Zimbabwe program reports from Harare.
Several banks started dispensing the South African and Chinese currencies in banking halls and automated teller machines or ATMs today, but the banking public complained that accessing the money was not easy. One of the depositors, Simon Mugwagwa, said he spent the better part of the day in a queue trying to withdraw cash, but to no avail.
The situation is very much hectic. We have been waiting here since, I think, 9 o'clock in the morning, and we are still waiting, and we are being told they have no money, even the rands and the yuan. So we are just waiting, hoping that maybe something will come out, but it doesn't seem so.
This was echoed by Tekla Zinyowera, who noted that she could not get either the South African rands or the Chinese yuan in the banking hall and ATMs. She said that the Botswana pula and the British pounds were also not accessible, adding that those currencies would be difficult to use in her daily errands.
Even if they give us the pula and the pounds, we are so confused about the exchange rate. And the shops, it's so difficult to buy anything with pula or pounds because the people in the shops, they don't know how to change the money. The exchange rate is just so basic.
Another depositor, Garikai Murendo, said he managed to withdraw some rands and yuans, but most retailers were not accepting those currencies, preferring the U.S. dollar.
It's difficult in using the yuan in the shops.
Some banking staff who refused to speak on tap said they failed to dispense the rand, yuan and other currencies because they were in short supply at their branches. Some other bankers who had accessed the rand and yuan said they could not transact because they had not been advised of the exchange rates by the central bank. Central Bank Governor John Mangunjga was not reachable on his mobile phone at the time of going on air. However, the central bank chief told the state-controlled Sunday Mail newspaper that the dispensing of multiple currencies would help in easing the ongoing shortages that started when the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe announced its plans to introduce bond notes. The RBZ's proposal is being rejected by many Zimbabweans who say that authorities are planning to reintroduce the Zimbabwean currency through the back door. Reporting from Harare, this is Thomas Chiripasi.
The London-based Global Witness Organization says 2015 was the worst year for killings of environmental activists. A report released Monday blames disputes linked to mining, agribusiness, logging, and hydropower and collusion between big business and government. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
For environmental activists, 2015 was an exceptionally dangerous year, according to a report from Watchdog Global Witness. Campaign leader Billy Kite spoke to VOA about the report's findings.
The numbers are shocking. We documented 185 killings across 16 countries. That's almost a 6% increase from the previous year and the highest annual total that we have on record. On average, more than three people were killed every week in 2015 defending the environment and their land rights. That's more than double the number of journalists killed in the same period. So we're seeing industries like mining, dam, agribusiness, encroaching more and more into previously untouched areas, rich in resources, and coming into conflict with local communities, particularly indigenous peoples.
The mining sector accounted for 42 deaths. The highest death tolls came from Brazil, with 50 killings, and the Philippines, with 33. In Colombia, there were 26 killings, and Peru and Nicaragua had 12 each. In Africa, the Democratic Republic of Congo reported 11 killings. Kite says fear and intimidation may mean the true numbers have been underreported. He blamed what appears to be collusion between big business and government.
So in Africa, it's been more difficult to get information. This may be because there's more repressive regimes, which means it's harder to get data on how many people are being killed or threatened. And also we're seeing less of a civil society presence, so less monitoring by local NGOs or journalists of this issue. Having said that, we have seen an increase last year in the criminalization of activists. So many high-profile activists who are fighting for land rights against agribusiness companies have been criminalized, taken to court, and charged under false pretenses.
For example, Cameroon's Nisako Basinji and Sierra Leone's Sima Matia were both threatened with expensive fines and imprisonment for their opposition to palm oil companies in their countries. The report says the charges were trumped up. Global Witness is calling for governments to strengthen protection for environmental activists and increase efforts to prosecute crimes against them. VOA contacted three organizations named by Global Witness as having connections to some of the killings: the Netherlands Development Finance Company, the Agua Zarca Dam Project, and palm oil company Denant. After 48 hours, none had responded to the Global Witness allegations. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, June 21st. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Let's give a shout out to listeners on these, our VOA affiliate stations, Radio Banga, FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, Radio Life in Lofa County, Brela FM in Nigeria, Kisi FM in Tanzania, and Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Judges in South Sudan's Wau State have joined their colleagues across the country in a nationwide strike to demand good working conditions, a provision for transportation, timely payment of salaries and allowances. A representative for the Wau judges says the strike will continue until the government addresses the judges' grievances across the country. As Michael Atit reports for VOA from Wau, citizens say the strike will encourage criminals to take advantage of the situation and cause disorder in the state.
The premises of the main court in Wau is empty, with police officers at the gate and some seated under mango trees. Many disappointed citizens kept coming into the court building and were told within minutes by the police officers to return home because the judges are on a strike. 52-year-old Peter Deng came to the court to follow his divorce case. Deng, who displays a visibly angry face, says he is disappointed with the judge's decision to strike. Speaking in Arabic, he says he hopes the judges will call for the strike and resume work quickly so that many cases like his can be resolved.
Now I am disappointed in my case. The judiciary is the pillar of the country. If they go on strike, criminals will get increased and police will not arrest anybody.
48-year-old Abraham Red Ibrahim also came to the court to follow his case over land dispute. Speaking in Arabic, he says even though his case will be delayed because of the strike, the judges have the right to go on a stage and work slow down.
I know the current situation doesn't favor anyone, but we are all aware of the economic situation of our country. And we also know that salaries have not been paid for more than 3 months. So we have no choice unless we wait till the strike is over.
Judge Kuch John Accord works at the Court of Appeal in Greater Bahr el Ghazal. He represents 22 judges in Wau. Speaking in Arabic, he says the current economic crisis in the country has forced judges to demand their rights.
We cannot continue working under a poor working condition, and we know that many cases will be pending. By law, we are supposed to work according to the law of the country. But how can you expect us to do so if we are not paid?
A court payment of salaries, allowances and provisions of transportation are among the 29 demands spelled out by the judges. Meanwhile, in Juba, the spokesperson for judges across the country says the judicial system in South Sudan was already paralyzed. Gary Raimondo says judges have coordinated the nationwide strike to let the people of South Sudan know who is responsible for the shortcomings in the delivery of judicial services. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
2 weeks after an attack by the Islamist group Boko Haram left at least 30 people dead, the Niger border community of Bosso has become a ghost town, but the area remains at risk to violence. Emily Yob reports.
A shoe, a helpful suitcase thrown in a backyard, the house doors left open. Most residents of Bosso left everything behind 2 weeks ago when the first gunshot rang through the town. Among them is El Haj Abba. Yes, we're scared. We don't have weapons, so it's no more to be scared, he says as he stands on top of his car, strapping a pile of belongings he can bring to the IDP camp he and his family now stay at. Abba is Nigerian. He fled to Bosso in Niger after Boko Haram militants wreaked havoc in his home country only a few miles away. But the armed group has been attacking several neighboring towns in Niger as well in the past couple of years, forcing populations to move back and forth between towns and makeshift camps located in the bush. It is not the first time that Bosso has been targeted. The most recent attack was on June 3rd. It was a Friday, just after 8 p.m., remembers resident Abdelaziz Zambada, who lived next to a police station that was targeted.
J'ai pris deux de mes enfants, madame a pris une. Le temps où on est sorti, le temps de revenir, c'est là où le billet est tombé.
I took one of my kids, my wife took two, he says. By the time we put them to safety and came back to fetch my daughter, a mortar hit my house. My neighbor's children and my daughter were killed. Officially, there were no civilians killed during the attack, only soldiers. But some bodies can still be found inside houses, and the smell of death is everywhere. Most of Bosso's estimated 25,000 residents left town. Two-thirds were refugees and internally displaced persons. Alarmed residents in the general area also left their homes, leaving an estimated 50,000 people displaced. On a deserted market street, the decomposing body of a goat dries under the scorching sun next to a ransacked stall. There is no water, no electricity or phone network, and very little food left in town after Boko Haram looted most of it. But despite all that, resident Suleiman Salisa decided to stay. He says, "We can tell it's going better. Yesterday we heard gunshot, but we were not worried." Salisa says the heavy military presence reassured him, and as a hairdresser, they are his only customers. There are not a lot of people left. It's disheartening, he says. We would like more residents to come back, and we need assistance with food, water, and electricity. That day, an official delegation led by Interior Minister Mohamed Bazoum visited the town for the first time since the attack and organized a meeting to reassure the population.
Les militaires sont là, vous l'avez constaté, un effectif conséquent.
He says the soldiers are here in substantial number and with a new strategy and a renewed morale. The conditions are met for the population to feel safe and come back. But this will take time, as the Islamic group continues attacks along the border, terrorizing the population and harassing authorities. The day before, they attacked and looted a police station in a border town just moments after an official delegation had driven away. Emily Yob for VOA News. Bosso.
Although Senegal is a former French colony, the English language is fast becoming a very popular subject of study in schools and universities across the country. Many people in Senegal believe that English has the best potential for modern-day communication, thus enticing many students to take the subject seriously in school. Reporter Alpha Diallo recently joined English lovers as they celebrated English Day in the eastern Senegalese town of Tambacounda.
Many students in high school and university here have opted to study English because of the belief that English has the best potential for modern-day communication. Against this backdrop, teachers, parents, and around 500 students and lovers of the English language recently converged to mark English Day at the cultural center in the Senegalese regional capital of Tambacounda. Although one might expect the subject to be all about language, it's also a chance for teachers and pupils to interact more freely and discuss topical issues that can't be accomplished during regular classwork. Among the subjects discussed were indiscipline in schools, teenage pregnancies, and early and forced marriages. Mrs. Fanta Fofana is an English teacher at the Mam Sheikh Mbaye High School in Tambacounda.
This problem is something that most of girls are facing, because if you take into account the amount of girls who pass from primary school to junior school, they are numerous. But before they get to high school, senior high school, you have many of them who resign because of early pregnancy or early marriages.
Mr. Isaga C, who helped set up the Tambacounda English Club, gave me his impression of English Day.
It's always a pleasure to be here among students and teachers, and I think this kind of event helps students express themselves and improve their English.
For five consecutive years now, English Day has been marked here with the aim of sharing a common platform between teachers, students, and parents. Mr. Omar Sise is the coordinator of the Tambacounda English Club. I asked him why the day is significant.
I think that it is just English is fun, and people think about choosing a day during which teachers of English, students of all the city of Tamba would get together and share in the language of English.
Students who were also giving ample opportunities to ask all types of questions gave me their impression.
My name is Suleiman Dao. I'm in New Lycée, Lycée Tambacounda High School. Today I'm very happy to celebrate this day because this day is the day of Englishmen. All Englishmen must come here and celebrate because, you know, English is now a language which is very important in the world.
My name is Sohna Saleh. I come from Mam
from Sheikh Mbaye High School. I come here today to celebrate this day, calling English Day, because first I like English very well. I like English so much that sometimes I say that it's something which is in my blood, and this day is an interesting day because it's not playing, laughing, eating, dancing, but we learn everything here.
The occasion was colorful with a wide variety of music played for entertainment.
Reporting for VOA News, this is Alpha Diallo in Tambacounda, Eastern Senegal.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. A very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak African Sports News, we begin with the football. Zambia play Lesotho before hosts and outgoing champions Namibia engage Mozambique. In the plate semifinal at the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup at the Sam Nujoma Stadium in Katutura Township, close to the capital Windhoek, today, Tuesday. The plate semifinals is being contested by teams that lost in the quarterfinals over the weekend. Meanwhile, Namibia Football Association Secretary General Barry Rukoro told the media in Windhoek that fans will have free access to watch the matches. Rukoro says they are doing this to show appreciation for the support fans displayed over the weekend. In rugby news, hosts England outplayed South Africa 39-17 in the semi-finals at the IRB Under-20 World Championship in Manchester on Monday. South Africa, the only team from the continent at the event, now face Argentina in the bronze medal playoff on Saturday. Meanwhile, Zimbabwe clinched the 2016 Olympic Repechage Men's Challenge Trophy in Monaco on Sunday. They beat Morocco 26-19 in the semifinals before outwitting Tonga 31-5 in the final. Turning to athletics, Kenya's Robert Kaptingei ran a lifetime best of 28 minutes and 15 seconds to triumph at the Corrida de Langu 10-kilometer road race in Brittany in northwest France on Saturday. Burundi's Olivier Irabaruta and Ethiopian Dawit Fikadu ran personal bests of 28 minutes and 17 seconds and 28 minutes and 24 seconds to place second and third, respectively. Meanwhile, 19-year-old Ethiopian newfind Meskerem Amare carried the day in the women's race in 32 minutes and 31 seconds. Finally, everyone on the 60-strong Kenyan team arriving in South Africa's Indian port city of Eteguini for the Africa Senior Athletics Championships today, Tuesday, seeks to attain the qualifying standard for the Rio de Janeiro Olympics, Kenya's head coach David Kitur told the media before they departed from Nairobi on Monday night. Kitur says they have huge expectations from the sprinters who are vying to match their middle and long distance compatriots in making their mark on the international scene. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, June 21st.
This is Bapa Adama Reporter from Gombe Local Government Area of Adamawa State, Nigeria. Americans, we are wishing you a heat-free and fair presidential election by November-December this year, 2016. We hope you will do everything possible to maintain the continuity in the White House. Any choice other than the continuity will be detrimental, destructive, and dangerous. And that will be the biggest mistake Americans will make in the history of the American politics. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. And that's it for this Tuesday, June 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Claudine and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.